You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, it's been 1 year since Russia launched its widespread invasion of Ukraine. Our guest says the war marks a new era in the international order. Now it's Food Friday. If you've ever thought about making your own Indian-style food at home but thought it might be too complicated, our guest has good news. You can create great flavors starting with a collection of six spices. She says with these six base spices, you can make Indian dishes that are healthy and can be made without a lot of difficulty. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite Indian food? Is there a specific Indian dish you've been wanting to try making yourself? If you cook Indian food at home, what's your go-to spice? If you grew up eating Indian food, if it's part of your own family's traditions, love to hear from you and maybe your own cooking advice. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Ruta Kahate is a chef, restaurateur, and author of three cookbooks, including Six Spices, 60 Dishes, Indian Recipes That Are Simple, Fresh, and Big on Taste. Her newest restaurant, Ruta's, will open in Walker's Point in Milwaukee this May. Ruta, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Before we get into the six spices themselves, and when I think of Indian food, I think India is a really big place, and there's a lot of different food traditions. You have a really unique story. You experienced a lot of those different traditions moving around India in your childhood. Can you talk about that and how it figures into your cooking?
Absolutely. My dad, he was in the Ministry of Finance, so he got transferred a great deal. And we literally went to four corners of India, wherever there was a currency note press or a mint, we would be posted there. And my family was very into food, and we would embrace whichever community or culture we were placed in. And so I grew up with lots and lots of flavors and different cooking techniques, different ingredients. Very, very lucky to have a childhood like that.
And part of your mission with this new cookbook and your previous one, Five Spices, 50 Dishes, is, you know, if anybody's out there thinking, I can't cook Indian food, you say, yeah, you can. Can you give us a pep talk?
Yes, absolutely. I love that. So Indian food, you know, as you mentioned, it is a very, very ancient, very vast, influences and differences from different parts of the country itself, which is geographically different. So, yeah, where do you begin? and having, you know, restaurants in the West kind of, you know, I mean, they have restaurant-style food. So you get this impression that all Indian food is that, you know, either heavily sauced or very complex, all of which Indian food can be. But what is the food that is easily accessible to people? And this is the kind of food I cook when I'm at home. I use minimal spices and still get the same flavors and nutrition just using, you know, five or six spices. So my entire goal with all my books has been to demystify Indian food, what I like to call simple but not simplistic. So it's not dumbed down, it's just simplified. So you're able to cook. Some of my recipes here have maybe just one spice or no spice at all. And it is possible to be very, very unmistakably Indian, even with that in that recipe.
All right.
So, you guys can do it.
Let's meet some of the spices. Now, I'm going to say the list, and then we'll pick a couple here. Oh, you've got cayenne, coriander, cumin seed, mustard seed, turmeric, and the new addition is asafoetida. Now, I'm going to cheat. I'm going to pick my favorite spice to cook with and to eat is cumin seed. Just used it last night, actually. Talk about cumin seed and the flavors it adds and the different ways we can use it.
Okay. So cumin belongs to the parsley family, and it has a sort of a peppery taste that, as you say, it's, you know, a little bit more widely known. There are many ways to use it. You can use it just raw, like, you know, and if you're going to use it just like as a whole seed raw, I recommend kind of crushing it in the palms of, you know, both your hands, to release the oils and the flavors before you add it to whatever it is you're adding it to. You could use it toasted, either dry toasted or toasted in oil, to where you where they release their, you know, qualities into the oil, or you can use a ground. So there are many ways to use this, and several of the recipes kind of demonstrate these different ways. And the other thing is Indian food is based on Ayurveda, which is an ancient form of living, really. That's what it kind of means, the science of life, but which is very much involves food. And spices are used there to help nutritionally. And cumin is a great digestive. So it's added to foods to make them easy to digest. But we also use cumin just to, you know, help with digestion. I mean, Indians are known to walk around with whole spices in their mouth. And I have taught my children to chew like a teaspoon of cumin after a particularly heavy meal to help with digestion. You can even make a tea with cumin. Just boil some water, add some cumin seeds, let it steep, and then you just sip that all through the day, and that just will help, you know, aid things along.
We're talking to Ruta Kahate, chef here in Wisconsin. Her new cookbook is called Six Spices, 60 Dishes, Indian Recipes that are simple, fresh, and big on taste. You can join the Food Friday conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite Indian dish you've made yourself, grew up eating, encountered in a restaurant, or maybe a friend of the family? Do you have questions about using the spices we're talking about? A favorite of those spices on that list: cayenne, coriander, cumin seed, mustard seed, turmeric, asafoetida. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Ruta, I want to key in on the spice you added from your previous cookbook. Now, there's five of those spices I think are household words here in the United States. You've added now asafoetida to the repertoire in the new cookbook. Can you tell us about that spice?
Sure. So Five Spices was written almost, I'm thinking, 16 years ago. it was pretty popular. It just went out of print after, I think, four runs. Just recently went out of print about a year ago. And so I've waited for those many years to add this sixth spice, only because it really wasn't known. And even now, I mean, it's still a little bit unknown, and that's kind of what I'm hoping this book will do, is bring it to the light a little bit more. But I did check before I wrote the book, I did check that it is available. It's available on Amazon, at, you know, certain health food stores. So asafoetida is a resin of a ferula herb. It goes, it's taproot, and it grows in the northern regions of India and Afghanistan and that area. And it's a wonder spice. So it is available in rock form in India, and there are different actually shades of color and, you know, type. But the one that you get widely in the West is in a powdered form. And it's also, by its name, you can tell it's fetid, you know, so it doesn't smell too good. It's also been called devil's dung. So it's a very strong smelling odoriferous spice, but it's a magic one. And what it does, and I don't know how to politely say this, but it basically removes gaps from the ingredients, but from your body as well. It makes things super easy to digest. So Indians will use it without fail in any bean preparation, or if you're using it in cruciferous vegetables, specifically for that reason. But the other great thing about it is that it tastes and smells, once it's added to hot oil, it will taste and smell like garlic and onions. That's the flavor profile. So, and then there are communities in India that don't eat aliens, or they don't eat these stronger ingredients like ginger, garlic, onion. Asafoetida helps with those reasons as well, you know. So it is quite the spice. And if you know how to use it, and which is where the book comes in, I think you'll be very pleasantly surprised.
It's Food Friday. We're talking with Wisconsin chef Ruta Kahate about her cookbook. It's called Six Spices, 60 Dishes, Indian Recipes That Are Simple, Fresh, and Big on Taste. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you'd like to join in, do you have a favorite Indian food you've tried, maybe had at a restaurant? You want to try to recreate it at home? Do you cook Indian food all the time? Do you have a question for our guest about how to use these spices most effectively? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We've got a few recipes that Ruta shared with us. They're up at WPR.org/Food Friday coming out. We'll check out one or two of them. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our Food Friday talk with chef and restaurateur Ruta Kahate about her latest cookbook. It's called Six Spices, 60 Dishes, Indian Recipes That Are Simple, Fresh, and Big on Taste. You can join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234. If you have favorite Indian dishes to eat and or to cook, if you have questions for Ruta about how to make things, how to use particular spices, love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Ruta, you shared some recipes with us. We've got them up at WPR.org/Food Friday. Let's check this out. Yogurt soup with dill. Tell us a little bit about this recipe. Ruta, are you there? Hearing a phone signal, not our guest right now. We'll try to get her back on the connection here in our Food Friday conversation. Meanwhile, I'll highlight those recipes. That soup I just mentioned is at WPR.org/Food Friday, along with jicama and mango salad and spicy red pickled chicken. Find all those recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday. Then try to make them at home and let us know how they are, how it goes. And you can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. While we try to reconnect with our guest, a big thank you to everyone who gave during our winter member drive this year. So great to hear from so many of you. As we said during the drive, you really do make a difference with your gift, and we really appreciate everyone who joined in, maybe for the first time, maybe for the third time, and of course to all the sustainers out there. If you're wondering what I'm talking about and you missed out, well, you could still give if you want to over at WPR.org. Again, that's WPR.org, and look for a how to donate there. I think we have Ruta back. Ruta, hi.
Hi. Great. Okay. Sorry about that. That's okay. What happened there?
Okay. So that's fine. We've got this yogurt soup with dill recipe. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. So yogurt, you know, soup. How do you make yogurt into a soup without curdling it? but Indian recipes abound with just that. So the trick is to kind of have something to emulsify it, whisky, without actually getting it to curdle. So we use chickpea flour, and it's like cornstarch, but without, you know, I don't know. I mean, I find it much more nutritious to use chickpea flour. And the idea is to have yogurt. Basically, Indians base a lot of their cuisine on dairy. And yogurt is eaten at almost every meal. And in the winter months, you make it into a hot soup. So here, what we do is we pretty much emulsify the yogurt with lemon juice, the chickpea flour, water. So you thin that out. A little bit of salt, a little bit of sugar, and the two spices, which are turmeric and cayenne, to give it some flavor and also the nutritional aspects of turmeric. And then you're going to give it a little bit of a hot oil dressing with two more spices. So you can heat a little bit of ghee, or which is clarified butter, or a little oil of your choice. And then when it's warm enough, you're going to add mustard, whole mustard seeds and whole cumin seeds. So this part is a little tricky, where you don't want your spices to burn, but you don't want them not to bloom, which means that they pop open and release their flavor. So the book kind of helps you through that, you know, hold your hand through it, where you heat it up just right, throw in your spices, let them sputter, and then very quickly you're going to add it to the simmering soup, which really, you know, aside from giving you all the flavor profiles, but it's also imparting the nutritional aspects of the spices I talked about earlier, and warming up your soup really well. We do finish this off with dill, which a lot of people, you know, some folks don't like dill. My kids cannot stand it. They don't want dill in their soup. So, you know, you totally can keep it out.
Could I do cilantro instead of dill if I wanted to?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, any herb, actually. Parsley will do. There is no reason not to use. And this is the other reason this book, one of the reasons this book is so precious to me, because I'm trying to get people to cook Indian food not just as a special meal, but with, you know, try to incorporate it into their regular repertoire. So yeah, throw in parsley instead.
We are having a Food Friday conversation with Ruta Kahate. Her new cookbook is 6 Spices, 60 Dishes, Indian Recipes That Are Simple, Fresh, and Big on Taste. Let's bring on a caller. Judith is with us in Milwaukee. Judith, hi.
Hi. I'm laughing as I'm dialing you in. I'm making split pea dal right at the moment, and using, I think, 4 of the 6 spices that your guest has been talking about. So I have turmeric and cumin and coriander. I put in some ginger, and then I've added a spoonful of curry powder from Penzies, which is really delicious curry powder, and it could have just put in 2 spoons of that and left everything else out, but I like having my own mix in there.
Judith, thanks a lot. We'll be by for dinner in a little while.
Thanks
a lot for sharing that. Aruta, thoughts on making a dal? She's using a split pea dal. A lot of times people use split peas or lentils of all shapes and sizes and colors, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. So dal, again, one of those, you know, basic necessities, you know, on an Indian table. I have a split pea recipe in this book as well, where I try to sneak in vegetables in any which way. And, you know, so mine has, I think, zucchini and green beans added to it. Dals are, again, dal is a very generic term. It could mean the whole bean. It could mean a split legume. It could mean the cooked product. But, you know, without dal, I think life is just, you know, sort of it's an unfinished thing. So, you can use any number of beans and make a very delicious dal. A lot of the recipes in this book, you could substitute dals as well. You don't quite have to stick to, if you're an expert and you have a bunch of dals in your pantry anyway, just mix and match.
Thanks a lot for that call. Enjoy the meal. Ruta, I wanted to bring up one of your points, one of your suggestions at the beginning of the book is to have a coffee grinder, electric coffee grinder that uses your spice grinder. So the chef late Floyd Cardoze was on the show about 7 years ago, and he had a book out then, and he persuaded me to do that, and it is so amazing. I'm addicted to like grinding up cumin and other spices in it. Can you talk about the benefits of taking those whole seed spices and grinding them up as opposed to using, you know, buying them in, say, powdered cumin form?
Absolutely. So yes, you must, and I would suggest having 2. Don't use your, you know, regular coffee grinder unless you want cumin flavored coffee. Yeah, in the
morning.
My wife
wants me really to be really clear. Like that one over there is for coffee. The one in the drawer is for spice. Don't mix them up.
Right. Don't mix it. But if you do mix them up, here's a quick little trick I use. Just raw rice, grind raw rice in the spice grinder, and it should clean it up and take that, you know, any leftover odors away. But yes, please, please buy your spices whole as far as possible. The only ones I will allow you to buy ground would be cayenne, because no one's going to like you grinding up your own red peppers, or turmeric, which is hard to come by whole. So turmeric is a root. It's part of the ginger family. And usually they're, you know, very rarely available whole in root form, and they're very hard. So they might even test your spice grinder a little bit. So those are okay to buy ground, but cumin, coriander, any of the other ones you use in your pantry, cloves, cinnamon, try and get them whole. And if it seems like they're hard to grind fine, a good trick is to just toast them very lightly, or put them in an oven on a very low, like 150 degrees or something, just to kind of warm them up, so they lose any moisture that they've gained by just sitting in a cupboard, and grind them fine. And by doing that, not only are you getting the entire potency of their flavor and aroma, but also their nutritional, they're all little nutritional bombs, you know, so you don't want to, having them sit out, they just turn into sawdust, really, if you've ground them and kept them for a while.
Ruta, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Ruta Kahate, a chef, restaurateur, author of 3 cookbooks. Her latest is 6 Spices, 60 Dishes, Indian recipes that are simple, fresh, and big on taste. Her latest restaurant, Ruta's, will open in Walker's Point, Milwaukee. That's scheduled for this May. Find a few recipes from Ruta over at WPR.org/Food Friday. Well, we got some spicy red pickled chicken, jicama and mango salad, and then that yogurt soup with dill we talked about. Or sub in other herbs if dill doesn't sound so good to you. Coming up Monday on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, lawmakers from both parties join the show with their reactions to Governor Evers' 2-year state budget proposal and a look at the road ahead to a state budget. That's Monday morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up today at 6 on 1A Plus, it's the Friday News Roundup. This week on the Roundup, the president makes a secret trip to Kyiv. There's news from Ohio, the U.S. Supreme Court, and even Grey's Anatomy, as viewers say goodbye to one of TV's longest-running characters. That's all coming up on the Friday News Roundup today at 6 on 1A Plus. Now, 1 year since Russia launched its widespread invasion of Ukraine and started a wider war that is still going on today, Secretary of State Antony Blinken spoke at the United Nations calling for continued global support for Ukraine. President Biden spoke in Warsaw, Poland after a surprise visit to Ukraine's capital.
A dictator bent on rebuilding an empire will never be able to ease the people's love of liberty. Brutality will never grind down the will of the free. And Ukraine will never be a victory for Russia. Never.
The White House today announced the U.S. will impose a new round of sanctions on Russians and supporters in other countries. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on the war at this point, 1 year after Russia invaded the whole of Ukraine? What questions do you have about how it's going, what's happened, what could happen next? Do you support continued support for Ukraine from the United States? What more, if anything, do you think Americans can or should be doing? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Tom Nichols is a writer at The Atlantic. He's the author of a number of books, including No Use, Nuclear Weapons and U.S. National Security. He spent 25 years as a professor of national security affairs at the United States Naval War College, began his career as an expert in Soviet and Russian affairs. Tom, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
You wrote a new piece for The Atlantic in the Daily Newsletter, not on the particulars of the fighting, but kind of a sense of what we've lost, the changing of an era and the hope you had after the fall of the Soviet Union. Can you share some of your reflections?
Sure. I think a lot of us who lived through that period as adults, I was 31 when the Soviet Union collapsed, and I had been to the Soviet Union multiple times before 1991. I think we had a real jolt of optimism to say, you know, the Cold War, this 15-year confrontation is over. That doesn't mean all our problems are over. It doesn't mean we've solved, you know, all of the trouble in the world. But I think it was a moment where we said, you know, we can start finding better ways to do things. We can start getting rid of nuclear weapons, which we remarkably have managed to get rid of a lot of them. We can cooperate on major problems. We can really cement the rules of the international system about not changing borders by force and, seeking diplomacy first and so on. And I think that the war in Ukraine, and I would remind people, this is the biggest war in Europe since the Nazis launched their campaign in 1939, really put an end to all of that. That we really are kind of having to plant the flag and stand in defense of freedom and democracy and a rules-based international order with something like an understanding that, you know, sovereign nations have the right to be free. And I just find that profoundly depressing because for 30 years, I had really hoped that we would find a different way.
It seemed like we had turned a corner from so much of history where I think there was a presumption that, hey, if my country's army is bigger than yours, we can redraw the map with that army, whether that's a next door neighbor or a colony. We had a pretty good run of not many of those kind of wars. Do you worry that this could open the door to that kind of thinking again?
Well, I worry that it'll open the door to that kind of thinking if the Russians win. Interestingly enough, one of the people who for years said that we shouldn't live in that kind of world where it shouldn't just be a matter of who has a bigger army, and that you shouldn't just erase other countries off the map was a guy named Vladimir Putin, who used to say all of the right things for the first 10 or 15 years that he was in power. And now I think he's an old man. He's decided that this is his legacy, that he's going to reconstruct some kind of empire in Europe. But yeah, we did have a good run with that for a long time. And I think, again, that's one of the things that's been, unfortunately, it's been lost, at least for now. But I think the outcome isn't over yet. And a lot will depend on whether the Russians win or lose in this war.
Turning to the war in particular, there were, I think, hopes at various points that the war would be over quickly, either from Putin and his supporters that Ukraine would fall within weeks. I think there were bursts of optimism in the West that Ukraine might roll Russian troops out of their country quickly. It doesn't seem like, Tom, anything is going to conclusively end. I don't know, anytime soon. What are you looking at?
Yeah, not anytime soon. And, you know, I was one of those people early on where I thought, well, this will, you know, the Russians are three times the size of Ukraine. They're attacking from three different directions along eight or nine strategic axes of advance. And, you know, this will be over pretty soon, unfortunately. But, you know, I think a lot of us underestimated the Ukrainians and way overestimated the Russians. And so I think none of those conditions have changed. The Ukrainians keep getting better and better, and the Russians are getting worse, in part because many of their best troops, some of their best forces, some of their best units, they just burned them in the first 3 months of the war. And now they're throwing literally, they refer to them, the expression here in English, of course, we talk about cannon fodder. In Russia, they refer to these new draftees as cannon meat. And they're just throwing these boys and men into a meat grinder, hoping to wear down the Ukrainians. So, yeah, this isn't going to end, you know, tomorrow. That's for sure.
Talking to Tom Nichols, he writes at The Atlantic, a longtime history as an expert in Soviet and Russian affairs. Looking at the one-year anniversary of the large-scale Russian invasion of Ukraine, you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and questions. Let's bring on a caller now. Giuseppe joins us in Kenosha. Giuseppe, hi.
Hi. Thanks. Thank you for taking my call.
What did you want to bring up?
Well, you were saying, what else can the United States do to help Ukraine? And to me, the problem lies with countries like Italy. I'm Italian myself, so that do not take a stronger position like England or Germany. You know, Italy's always had some kind of business with financial business with Russia, and one of the prime ministers in Italy also had a closer connection with Putin. So they're dragging their feet in being more assertive, and I think it's important that, like the gentleman before said, they have a lot of men in Russia. They keep throwing men there. So, and if countries like Italy and Hungary don't stand stronger, then there's a risk that the coalition weakens, and that's what Putin wants. He wants, you know, like somebody that weakens the wall that's been built.
Giuseppe, thanks a lot for the call. Giuseppe worried about some NATO partners, including Hungary and Italy. Italy, where the prime minister is showing support, but Silvio Berlusconi, coalition member, former prime minister, very close with Putin, very critical of Ukraine and Zelensky. Tom, and it seems like one of Putin's main hopes is that exactly what Giuseppe is worried about happens, that the coalition doesn't hold together in supporting Ukraine.
Yeah, I think Putin counted on that early on to say, you know, NATO, you know, everyone will be outraged for a few weeks and then it'll all die down and we'll all go back to business as usual while Russia absorbs and loots Ukraine. That didn't happen. And I think what's really one of the things I find remarkable after a year of war is how united NATO is at this point. In fact, I think that unity has actually been growing rather than declining, in part due to the actions of the Russians themselves. That, you know, Putin has no interest in negotiations, and he is, you know, the vice president made the point the other day, these are crimes against humanity. This isn't just a war. I mean, there are crimes against humanity, war crimes underway, including things like kidnapping children and taking them to Russia, targeting civilians intentionally. And so I think if Putin was counting on this, he has to be disappointed. And I think it was really a turning point, a watershed moment when President Biden went to Kiev and walked the streets of the Ukrainian capital with Zelensky, because that really was a commitment on the part of the Americans to say, we're in this, we're not going anywhere. You know, a year later, we're not getting tired of, you know, hearing about this war, and we're going to be with you for as long as it takes. And again, I think in some ways, Putin has only himself to blame for that. Because once the war went badly, he just couldn't reassess. I mean, his whole strategy has just been to get a bigger hammer and kill more people. And, you know, I truthfully never thought I would be sitting here thinking about Finland and Sweden being in a NATO, you know, that would be 32 countries. But the Russians have managed to make that a possibility.
Thanks for the call, Giuseppe. We're talking to Tom Nichols, staff writer at The Atlantic, looking at the first anniversary of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guest, a longtime observer of the Soviet Union and then of Russia? How do you think the war could or should end? What role do you want to see the U.S. play? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Tom Nichols, Russia expert and staff writer at The Atlantic, looking at the war in Ukraine 1 year to the day after Russia launched its large-scale invasion of the country. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Mark is with us in New Berlin. Mark, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I think that we're really slowballing the arms and munitions that they need. It's pathetic, really, that we can't give them tanks immediately, that they couldn't have the MiG fighters that were in Poland that were left over there, that they would have at least had those jet planes and more equipment that we have available. It was President Clinton, unless I'm wrong, that promised that we would defend the Ukraine if they would give up their nuclear weapons. They'd have nothing to worry about. We would protect them. And we've got a weak president. He's not doing it.
Mark, thanks for the call. Two main points there. Tom, first of all, Mark says we're not getting arms and ammunition to Ukraine fast enough.
Yeah, I think Mark's absolutely right. The United States and other countries are big, clumsy bureaucracies that really weren't meant to do what they're trying to do now, which is to move arms to a non-allied but friendly country. And, you know, I wish that we were doing it more quickly as well. I mean, I think some of this is just bureaucracy and just the sluggishness of large organizations trying to move things around. On the other hand, there were people who were certain that we weren't going to be able to get weapons to the Ukrainians in time for them to survive the winter, that, come the first snowfalls in November or December, that, you know, this whole thing was going to go down the tubes for the Ukrainians. And that hasn't happened. We've gotten them long-range artillery and a lot of other weapons. And I think you're going to see that improve. But as a general point, absolutely agree with your caller that this, we should be doing this faster and more effectively.
Mark, thanks for the call. Mark also mentioning past commitments, Ukraine giving up the nuclear weapons that was on its soil. Does Mark have the history there about right?
Yeah, no, this is, I was happy to agree with Mark a moment ago, but I have to correct him on some of the history here. What he's thinking of is the Budapest Memorandum of 1994. And that was a joint declaration by the United States, Great Britain, and Russia. But Russia at that point was under President Boris Yeltsin, who was a much more Western-facing leader than Putin is. And it said that all of these countries resolved to respect the sovereignty of Ukraine. The problem was that the Ukrainians keeping their nuclear weapons was never a realistic option. Most of those weapons that were based in Ukraine were actually strategic weapons that were aimed at us. And I actually think, and I've written about this, if people want to find it on the internet, I've written pieces where I think had the Ukrainians kept their nuclear weapons, the Russians probably would have invaded them a lot sooner, perhaps 10 or 15 years ago, on the pretense that Ukraine back then, still pretty unstable in its politics, that they would have said, we just can't have an unstable country, you know, with loose nuclear weapons in them. And I think that actually would have been more dangerous. But because, especially because a lot of those weapons were not tactical level nuclear weapons, but the long range weapons that are aimed at the United States. So I still think getting rid of those weapons was the right thing for the Ukrainians to do. I don't think anybody would want to see a nuclear war being fought in Central Europe. And the Russian government that signed off on that was Yeltsin's government, unfortunately. By the way, the Budapest Memorandum, the one requirement is that if there's a problem, this one of the signatories has to take it to the UN Security Council. It's not a treaty of defense or alliance where it's, you know, you're going to defend them militarily. And of course, we did that. We went to the UN Security Council. The big problem right now is that the UN Security Council has Russia sitting on it, a country that's basically acting like a nuclear armed rogue state. So, you know, the United Nations is kind of out of play right now. But that's what that memorandum was about.
Let's go back to our callers. Mike is with us in St. Lawrence. Mike, hello.
Hi. Just a quick comment. I'm not a very good historian, but I just want to say, in shock and awe was the theme for the Iraq invasion, based on a false premise of weapons of mass destruction, which reminded me of the false premise of going into Vietnam. Both involved the United States invading another country, basically for supposedly the stop of communism and then supposedly to corral weapons of mass destruction. I don't agree with what Putin is doing, but it's the same kind of power grab that the United States has done over the years. And I just wish the Ukrainian people the best, but I hope this comes to a peaceful resolution. I agree with your guest.
Mike, thanks for the call. Tom, do you agree with the parallels Mike is drawing there?
Yeah, I don't. I think, you know, with Vietnam, it's easy to forget now that we actually had a treaty of alliance with the Vietnamese. And had we not come to their aid. And, you know, we can debate the wisdom of whether that was the right thing to do or not, but South Vietnam probably would have fallen sometime in 1965 or 66. And there, you can actually listen to LBJ on, you know, on recordings, talking to other members of the government and Congress saying, you know, what, I don't want to go into Vietnam. What am I supposed to do here? We didn't take over Iraq and try to absorb it as, you know, the 51st state. I think what people really need to understand is Putin has said, and he has said for years, Ukraine doesn't exist. It's not a place. It's not actually a country. What Putin's doing is the equivalent of what Saddam Hussein did in 1991 when he said, Kuwait is not a country. It's the 19th province of Iraq. And I think the question that people need to wrestle with is, do you want to live in a world where a large nuclear-armed power can simply reach out and say, you don't exist anymore as a country. We are your new government, and, you know, we will occupy you and take what you have and plant our flag there, and, you cease to exist. You're now part of Russia. I suppose the equivalent would be if the United States had invaded Canada or Mexico and said, that's it. We've annexed them. They're ours. There is no Mexico. There is no Canada. They're just, you know, American territory now, because that's what Putin did. So, I mean, that's not to excuse or whitewash a lot of, you know, stupid and aggressive things that the United States has done in its history. But I think to understand what Putin did, you really have to understand that this was crossing an international border and literally trying to wipe another country out of existence by just taking it over. And I think if you're thinking about historical parallels, the invasion of South Korea, the invasion of the Falkland Islands, the invasion of Kuwait by Iraq, those are actually the parallels.
Thanks for that call. We heard from Kurt in Brookfield, who couldn't stay on the line and is asking, what is the final outcome Putin wants? And I think, Tom, a lot of people are puzzling over that question. What are your thoughts on that?
You know, it's a great question, because what Putin wanted was a quick collapse, Zelensky to either be dead or flee the country, and pro-Russian elements in Kiev saying, thank you for liberating us, you know, right? We'll be great. This is one place where there's a good parallel, where just like the Americans, you know, in Iraq, Putin said, we'll be greeted as liberators. I'll be throwing flowers in the streets. And he thought that was going to happen, and that the Russian Federation would include this gigantic piece of territory and 40 million more people that we once called Ukraine, that he would now call, you know, Little Russia. What he wants now, who knows? I think he has placed himself in a trap. He's painted himself into a corner that he can't get out of. And so, again, as I said earlier, his only answer is to get a bigger hammer and murder more people until what I think he hopes happens is that literally NATO gets tired of this, the West gets tired of it, the European Union gets tired of it, Zelensky is, you know, somehow booted out of office, and the Russians are finally welcomed in. I think Putin cannot admit a mistake. People need to understand, Putin is a very vain and emotional man. He is not going to admit a mistake here, because the other problem is that if he admits this mistake, he could be deposed internally in Russia at some point. And so I think what he's going to do is just keep killing people in the vain hope that the original plan somehow magically comes about, that Ukraine becomes part of Russia, which is just never going to happen.
Tom, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
Tom Nichols is a staff writer at The Atlantic. We talked to him today on what he calls a grim anniversary, 1 year since Russian forces directed by President Putin invaded Ukraine. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, a new report finds big problems and challenges when it comes to the mental and emotional well-being of teenage girls in the United States. We'll look at the problem, the findings of that report, and at some possible solutions as well. And there's a lot of great stuff to do here in Wisconsin, some well-known, some off the beaten path. We're going to get some inspiration with the author of the new book, 100 Things to Do in Wisconsin Before You Die. And I hope you'll share some of your favorites as well. That's all Monday here on Central Time.